Hello, I'm Jerry Bradley. This is number 0511, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0511. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, animator Tom Seto, author of Eat, Drink, Animate, An Animator's Cookbook. Was he worried about not gathering enough recipes?
I was concerned about that. And what was kind of funny about it was that it was such a daffy idea, like so out of left field, that once I started asking people, they all went, oh yeah, I got a recipe. Yeah, okay. You know, like Michael Giacchino's like multi-Oscar winner, you know, he's like, oh yeah, I got a recipe for you. And Chuck Jones's family sent me, you know, one of their recipes, and Frank Thomas, who's the lead animator of Pinocchio. People just started to volunteer recipes. I ended up with 83 recipes from about 73 contributors from all around the world.
Dr. Mark Kimmons, author of Medical Cannabis in Canada.
It wasn't written specifically to coincide with recreational legalization. It was written instead to answer a large volume of questions I was getting from both the general public, patients, and providers about medical cannabis. When I was giving public lectures on the topic, I was getting so many of the same repeat questions over and over and over, I began to compile answers to those questions, and it just seemed to make sense. There was so much demand and hunger for knowledge on this subject that I put it together in a book format.
Former CIA officer Jason Hansen, author of Agent of Influence, How to Use Spy Skills to Persuade Anyone, Sell Anything, and Build a Successful Business.
One of the things I always say is that spies are the world's best salesmen. That's because you're trying to recruit somebody to obviously spy for your country. And one of my fellow CIA officers, I like how she said it, she said, spies are the world's best salesmen. The only difference is you sell vacuums, I sell treason. So spying can absolutely be applied to the business world.
And of course, there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0511, was Jerry Bradley, who is a new Patreon patron of the Stuff File program. He's also the operations manager for Cosentino Canada in Calgary, Alberta. Thank you very much, Jerry, for doing the guest late. And most importantly, thank you very much for being a Patreon patron of the show. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Indianapolis Metropolitan Police officers were led on a chase late on May 26th after a reckless driver nearly hit a patrol car. Ignoring signs and warnings about a bridge out ahead, the driver tried to jump the bridge Dukes of Hazzard style, but when he came to the end of the pavement, his car hit the exposed beams on the bridge and skidded to a stop. The driver got away, but police apprehended a passenger who informed them the driver had one leg and had left his prosthetic leg behind in the car. Police said they were confident they'll track him down soon. Okay, so let me see if I've got this straight. The guy on one leg got away from the cops on foot. Nice. A 40th birthday outing ended on a sour note for Neil Edward Cecil, the birthday boy, and 31-year-old Lee Godwin. After a few drinks, the two stopped for a cheeseburger on April 27th at McDonald's in Chester, England, where they found a duck walking around the restaurant. Kindly, the men helped the bird find its way out of the building, but they somehow ended up arguing over it, which escalated into a brawl. When officers arrived, Godwin lunged at one of them, shouting about how he had saved a duck. Edward Cecil tried to jump in and help Godoin, only to be pepper sprayed. Both men were arrested and later admitted to being intoxicated and resisting a constable. "I am ashamed for the way I have acted," Edward Cecil told the court. Well, so far, there's been no comment from the duck, but I could imagine what it might say.
"You're despicable."
Okay, as a Canadian, I'm assuming from this next story that there must be some sort of leech shortage in this country. What other explanation could there be? Otherwise, why would a man try to smuggle nearly 5,000 live leeches in a grocery bag on a flight from Russia to Toronto's Pearson International Airport? The discovery was made after a dog working with border agents smelled the leeches. The leeches were identified as Hirudo verbena, one of only two species of medicinal leeches that come under regulations aimed at controlling wildlife trade. Now, according to a statement from authorities, these species are regulated because over-harvesting of medicinal leeches from the wild is a major threat to the species. Okay, here's some info for you. The parasites, which drink the blood of animals and humans, were one of the first species subject to conservation measures dating back to 1823. Medicinal leech saliva contains blood-thinning properties and was vital in the first positive results of human dialysis treatments. The more you know. Ippolit Bodanov was charged with unlawful import of a regulated species and fined $11,000. You know, somewhere in Toronto is someone who has read this story and is now repulsed at the idea that they were sitting for hours on a flight from Russia with a guy beside them carrying 5,000 leeches, live leeches, in a shopping bag. I'll bet that person started to swear like Samuel L. Jackson in Snakes on a Plane. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, 23-year-old Brian Bellis of Egg Harbor City, New Jersey, proudly posed for a video while he put down his beer to pee in public onto a memorial for a 9-year-old boy killed in 2012 by a brain tumor. The video, shot by Bellis's friend, 23-year-old Daniel Flippin, was posted on Snapchat. It went viral, leading to the young man being vilified. Bellis has already been fired from his job. He was wearing a shirt with the company's logo and name clearly visible. Bruce Bellis Plumbing and Heating. That's right. His father tossed him out of the family business. His son has been charged with public urination, and Flippin has been charged with possession of an open container of alcohol in public. "We apologize to the family," Bruce Bellis said. "Ultimately, it's my fault. Maybe we didn't teach him right." Well, you certainly are teaching him right now, Pops. Your son has gone from plumbing to just plumb stupid. And unemployed. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? We've had Tom Seto on the show before. He's an animator who has worked on such classics as The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, The Lion King, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and more. He also teaches, and he's put out several books about animation. But his newest book is certainly a unique one. It's a cookbook called Eat, Drink, Animate, An Animator's Cookbook. Tom joins us now via Skype from California. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks once again for being on the program with us. You know, one of the things about this job is that I get to ask questions, and the thing I got to ask right off the bat is, how did this idea come up? Is this sort of like you got peanut butter in my chocolate? I mean, where did these two things come together?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was talking with another animation historian about collaborating on some projects, and we were kicking around some ideas. And then I thought, you know, many years ago in the 70s, when I was a young assistant, I had a chance to work underneath Grim Natwick, And Grim Natwick was the artist who designed Betty Boop for Max Fleischer. And he also was the head of the Snow White unit for Walt Disney. And he lived to be 100 years old. And he was still animating in his 80s. He was an amazing, amazing man, originally from Missouri, from Chillicothe, Missouri. And when you work for Grimm, after the completion of a project, one of the things he would do is that he would, if he liked you, he would give you his personal chili recipe. So I thought, okay, I've got the chili recipe, the guy who created Betty Boop. You know, and then I also used to be friends with an animator named Benny Washam. And Benny was a lead animator for Chuck Jones. And Benny always used to do, like, the last Bugs Bunny shot, you know, when Bugs would look at the camera and say something witty, like, "And mud spelled backwards is dumb," or something like that. And Ben was a short order cook before he was an animator. So he had some recipes. And then I had a recipe of Hayao Miyazaki cooking ramen for his crew. And I said, you know, I could do a cookbook. And the publisher was like, "That's an incredible idea." And then, like, when 48 hours later, I had paperwork. It's like, okay, they want me to do this.
Okay, so you said you want to do this, and you just gave us three ideas that are great ones. But after you said this, did you suddenly look around and go, okay, I know I could do this, but are there enough out there that I could gather?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I was concerned about that. And what was kind of funny about it was that it was such a daffy idea, was like so out of left field, that once I started asking people, they all went, "Oh yeah, I got a recipe. Yeah, okay." You know, like Michael Giacchino is like multi-Oscar winner, composer. He's like, "Oh yeah, I got a recipe for you." And Chuck Jones's family sent me, you know, one of their recipes, and Frank Thomas, who's the lead animator of Pinocchio. And just people just started to volunteer recipes. And next, I ended up with 83 recipes from about 73 contributors from all around the world, from like, you know, Iran, from, Tom Moore, who did The Secret of Kells, sent me a Irish vegan recipe from Limerick. People just started sending me recipes. And what was fascinating about it was that, I think when your full-time career is working with virtual imagery, like, you know, an animated character, you know, is an image on a screen or an image on a piece of paper, and it comes to life, you know, when they put it all together. But so you're dealing with a virtual world. It's interesting how a number of people I know who work in that sort of abstract, you know, sort of like, reality, when they relax, they want something tactile. You know, like I know a lot of computer programmers who love gardening or refinishing furniture, you know, on the side. And a number of them like to cook. So that's sort of the origin of it.
Now, have you had an opportunity to test out all of these recipes before they went to print?
Oh, yeah. You usually do that. Yeah, I had a few people helping me out. One was a story artist named Robert Lentz, who was the lead storyboard artist on Pixar's Toy Story, and he studied to be a cook before he became an artist. So he had a great time helping out with a lot of the recipes. Of the different chefs who contributed, three became full-time professional cooks. One was an assistant animator on Fern Gully, The Last Rainforest, and The Iron Giant, who left the business and today is a chef at the Ritz-Carlton in Tampa, Florida.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really interesting. He used to have a convection oven in his desk. And and people would say, "Hey, break time, Eric's cooking, yay!" You know, and everybody would run down to the seventh floor, you know, and these wonderful smells would come because he was cooking, you know. And it's interesting because you have recipes like that are like really gourmet, you know, style recipes. And then another fellow who used to direct death metal videos sent me a recipe for a drink called Picklebacks, which is whiskey and pickle juice. You throw back one, then throw back the other, repeat.
Now, the commonality with all of these recipes are they come from animators. But besides that commonality, is there anything else that these recipes have in common? Did you find that animators have a certain flair or a certain style of culinary skills or desires?
Not a commonality. Sometimes it's a generational thing. I noticed that the artists who were raised during the Great Depression, came of age during the 20s and 30s, their recipes tended to be very Spartan. They were very simple. So, like Walt Disney, like Walt Disney could eat corned beef hash out of a can and be happy. You know, like he wasn't caught up with the gourmet flavor of things. Some of his other people said sometimes for lunch he would just take, two or three cold hot dogs out of the fridge and chew on them, and that was lunch for him. So that generation tended to be more basic. And then starting, in the 60s and 70s, people started to get more elegant, in their preparation, and also getting more international. Trying more international dishes and all. So there's a lot more dim sum and dumplings and, things like that.
Now, I know it's your book, and this is something that is like your baby, and everything in the book is like your children. But having said that, do you have a favorite child?
No, I love them all. Yeah, it's hard to choose, but... It is funny, because the recipes go from very simple to very complex, and there's a lot of layers, levels in between. But I enjoy just trying them. And then with each recipe, too, I tried to kick in some small stories just about life around the studio. Because, some of the people who are watching the finale of Game of Thrones, there was that documentary they did about the behind the scenes and about the crew. And on big films, animated films as well as live action films, the crews sort of get together and they live like a family, and they share things with one another and, recipes and go do parties together, things like that. Like Disney's in the 1940s, a lot of the artists used to do what's called house parties, which was, you couldn't really afford to go to restaurants and nightclubs all the time. I mean, whenever you see Hollywood stuff, that was always like the celebrities and the producers, and that stuff was all arranged by the studio. So, Cesar Romero and Frank Sinatra would go to the El Macambo and be photographed, sipping, martinis. That was like a thing that the publicity department set up. The average film worker in Hollywood at the time, everybody would get at somebody, go to somebody's house, and you would spin records and dance and do a potluck and all, and do a house party. And the Disney artists used to, in the 40s, used to do this thing called the special, which was you took a wash tub and you put a block of ice in it, and you poured in bottles of Chablis and bottles of gin, and threw some fruit on top of it. And that was like the evening's entertainment, was when the drink would hit you.
So who would you say is the biggest potential audience for your book? Fans of animation or fans of food?
I think probably a little both. I'm hoping both. It'll probably be the animation people. Because, one of the crazy things about this book was, this is the first book I wrote where I thought, I don't give a damn if anybody reads this. I just want to write it. I just think this would be a fun book to do. And everybody who volunteered recipes did it in that spirit. They just thought, this is just going to be a frolic for us all. And I think everybody enjoyed, contributing and putting things in.
Well, the book, again, is called Eat, Drink, Animate, An Animator's Cookbook. It's written by Tom Cito. Tom, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Great. Thanks again for having me.
Animator Tom Cito, author of Eat, Drink, Animate, An Animator's Cookbook. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the show page for this program, which is show number 0511, and you'll find links to Tom's site. and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. Tom's always been great to talk to. As I mentioned in the intro to our chat, he has worked on such films as The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and The Lion King. And all of those films have since been made into live-action flicks. So I was curious to find out how he felt about animated films being redone as live-action. But we ran out of time for this show. However, Patreon subscribers to the Stuff File program, you can hear that question and more as a Patreon reward extra. Just go to our Patreon page, and if you're not already a member, become one of the select patrons of the show. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're experiencing The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Medical Cannabis in Canada, and we'll also talk to Jason Hansen, author of Agent of Influence. We have an Idiot of the Day coming your way and lots more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can be heard via Google Play and iTunes. Just click on the Google Play or iTunes button located on the website at thestufffile.com, and whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff. Houston police are trying to wipe out a recurring crime wave by flushing out the identity of a man who's been caught on surveillance cameras defecating on lawns and driveways in the city's Woodland Heights neighborhood. The disgruntled dumper has been leaving messes all over the neighborhood and has pooped at one house at least six times. Said Patrick Reese, who lives nearby, "It's definitely not a nice thing to do to people. Going to the bathroom on their driveway is not nice. It's definitely not something that's supposed to be in polite society." Well, thank you for those words of wisdom, Captain Obvious. It is believed that the serial pooper usually strikes late at night or early in the morning under the cover of darkness. The man usually cleans up after himself with a paper towel and then leaves the soiled sheet on the sidewalk. "This is our neighborhood," area resident Amy Parsons said. "Whatever people think should go on around here, pooping is not okay. We don't want dogs pooping in our yards. Why would we want a human?" Let's hope she's asking that question rhetorically. Now, deputies say the man will be charged with indecent exposure or a criminal mischief charge when he is caught. Okay, I got a question. Much like the quandary of if a tree falls in the forest but no one is there to hear it, does it make a sound? I have to ask, if a guy in the middle of the night does his business in your driveway but no one is there to see it happen, is it really indecent exposure? I mean, criminal mischief, sure, but doesn't someone have to witness exposure for it to be exposure? Just asking. Authorities say an 11-foot alligator busted through a kitchen window and broke several bottles of red wine in a Florida home before it was captured. I guess it prefers white wine. The gator was removed from Mary Wishhausen's Clearwater condominium early Friday. No one was injured. Mary uses a walker. She said that the moment she saw the lumbering reptile, she moved into her bedroom, closed the door, and called police. She played computer games while waiting for help to arrive. Clearly, this is a woman who has seen it all, done it all, and isn't fazed. Mary says it took two trappers and 10 police officers 2 hours to get the alligator out of the home where she has lived for almost four decades. You know, it doesn't mention which computer game she was playing while waiting for authorities to show up. I hope she was playing Tuba Croc. Anyway, authorities say a ball python slithered out of a toilet and bit a South Florida man on the arm. Well, that's not the worst place he could have been bitten. The man was treated at the scene after the 4-foot snake bit him when he lifted the toilet seat. The snake is non-venomous. The snake didn't belong to the man, and it was unclear how it got into the apartment. The Coral Springs Humane Society took the snake to a veterinarian's office. It was being treated for a scale infection. Over the years, other creatures have found their way into toilets in South Florida, including an iguana freed by Fort Lauderdale Fire Rescue in March. Now, if you think things only try to eat you or bite you in Florida, think again. Let's move way up north to New Hampshire for our next story. A New Hampshire man got a big surprise when he went to close his iPad. A bat was wedged between the back of the device and its cover, and it bit his finger.
Holy known unknown flying objects!
Roy Syvertson of Southampton says it felt like a bee sting at first.
Holy understatements, Batman.
When he realized he was dealing with a bat, he pressed down on the cover of the iPad to keep it from flying away.
Holy one-track bat computer mind.
The 86-year-old managed to get the bat outside, but later found him dead. It turned out that the bat was rabid.
Holy heart failure!
Syvertson went to the hospital for rabies treatments. When asked how the bat got into his house and iPad case last week, Syvertson had a ready-made response. He quipped, "My joke of he probably knew my password won't last forever."
Holy, here we go again, Batman.
Yes. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Dr. Mark Kimmins is the author of a new book that's coming out in August called Medical Cannabis in Canada. It's the first comprehensive Canadian guide on the applications and benefits of medical cannabis. Dr. Kimmins is also the president of Natural Health Services. He joins us on the line right now from British Columbia. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks very much for being on the program with us. Did you bring this book out to coincide with the fact that Canada recently, last year, legalized cannabis, or was this something that was always on the back burner for you?
A little bit of both. I have always believed in the legalization of cannabis, and in fact, in 1980, I wrote my grade 8 high school paper on why cannabis should be legalized, so it sort of has come full circle for me. But it wasn't written specifically to coincide with recreational legalization. It was written instead to answer a large volume of questions I was getting from both the general public, patients, and providers about medical cannabis when I was giving public lectures on the topic. I was getting so many of the same repeat questions over and over and over, I began to compile answers to those questions, and it just seemed to make sense. There was so much demand and hunger for knowledge on this subject that I put it together in a book format.
What's the biggest question you normally get? And also, what's the biggest myth about medical cannabis? And are the two the same?
Well, good questions. And I'll start by saying no. Recreational cannabis and medical cannabis are distinct, even though they have origins in the same plant. So I think that's where the confusion comes from. The difference, of course, is not only in the intention of the user. The recreational user is deliberately using something to get some degree of euphoria or mild intoxication, the same way someone might choose to use recreational alcohol consumption. Whereas a medical patient is choosing to use medical cannabis products for relief of symptoms, ideally with no impairment at all. And based on that differentiation of intention of use, we have different product lines. So traditionally, recreational cannabis has been used in the whole plant format, and traditionally the most common way to utilize it was smoking. Whereas for medical patients, smoking is not recommended generally for medical use. Most patients prefer oral formulations, and the most common medical-specific formulations take advantage of the fact that many of the plant chemicals in the cannabis plant are not psychotropic or impairing. So if you take a preparation that is higher in those non-psychotropic cannabinoid chemicals, then you can take advantage of many of the medicinal benefits, providing relief of symptoms without impairment, without going for what the recreational user is looking for, which is some degree of euphoria and impairment.
Is this something that is still cutting edge, still new? In other words, how on board is the medical profession as a whole when it comes to medicinal cannabis?
Well, that's a great question. In some ways, it's very much cutting edge, and in some ways, it's absolutely the opposite. We have approximately 5,000 years of documented use of cannabis as a medicine amongst human beings. And if you could sort of turn back time and go back 100 years, we had actually a flourishing and thriving medical cannabis industry in North America, where major pharmaceutical companies were researching, publishing papers, manufacturing medical cannabis products, and it was fairly well known. And then we went through a relatively recent approximately 100 years of stigma and prohibition, where cannabis became completely illegal, and really any doctor who's alive and practicing today grew up during that time of stigma and prohibition. So for many of the doctors, it is somewhat surprising that cannabis is emerging as a potential medicine. But in fact, if you go back far enough, it's not new at all.
Okay, so if doctors are on board, you just talked about the stigma back in the days when it was an illegal substance. If doctors are on board, is there any difficulty as a medical practitioner to convince patients who might not have been part of the marijuana generation or cannabis generation to agree to use cannabis because they think it's something that they shouldn't be using?
Well, actually, Peter, in fact, it's somewhat the opposite. There is incredibly strong demand for medical cannabis by patients in Canada, particularly amongst the senior demographic. A lot of Canadian seniors are realizing that this is a medicine that is incredibly safe, which can be used with the guidance of a physician to relieve symptoms without impairment. A lot of these symptoms are age-related type of symptoms. And in fact, the demand from patients is stronger than the ability for doctors to catch up. And as a medical doctor myself, I understand why this is happening. When you go through medical school and years of rigorous training, that's really your core body of knowledge, and that's what you use as a foundation for your practice. And when something so-called new, in this case, it's the old becoming new with medical cannabis, is reintroduced, there is a real lag period for doctors to catch up. And one of the factors and complexities with regard to this is, while we have over 20,000 published studies on cannabis out there, many of these are not the traditional sort of pharmaceutical drug studies that doctors typically require in order to incorporate new medicines into their practice. So one thing you'll often hear from practitioners who didn't learn about this in medical school or residency training is that there's no evidence to support cannabis. Well, that's simply not true. As I mentioned, there's over 20,000 published papers, but there is a deficit or lack of those traditional pharmaceutical trials. And so there's going to be a catch-up period where doctors become comfortable. So overall, I would say the patient demand, it exceeds the comfort of most doctors in Canada currently.
What are some of the things that medical cannabis can be used for, and how can it help them?
One of the remarkable things, many remarkable things about medical cannabis, is the potentially large number of human ailments and symptoms which can be relieved with medical cannabis. In fact, the list is so large that it's sort of it's hard to understand how one potential medicine could target so many diseases. And the reason that it works this way is we actually have a system in our bodies called the endocannabinoid system, and it's a system of receptors and naturally produced molecules in our body that act on these receptors, and it turns out to be very widely distributed throughout our bodies. And this system, more and more research science is showing how this endocannabinoid system is involved in the maintenance of homeostasis or balance processes within our bodies. And so this explains how the many chemicals from the one plant in the medical cannabis products can target many of these different body systems. So to go back to your question as to what symptoms or ailments, medical cannabis helps. We know in Canada that the three top reasons for which Canadians access medical cannabis are chronic pain, anxiety and depression, and sleep disorders. But interestingly, among those common three reasons, we really only have good scientific evidence supporting the use of medical cannabis in chronic pain. We don't yet have the good studies to support use in anxiety, depression, and sleep disorders, although those are emerging. We do have some very good scientific evidence to support the use of medical cannabis in other potentially more rare conditions, including pediatric drug-resistant epilepsy, in pain and spasticity of multiple sclerosis, in nausea and vomiting associated with chemotherapy, and various forms of chronic pain. But it turns out that the emerging evidence is, as I mentioned, showing potential and likely benefit in a much wider range of conditions, including potentially autoimmune conditions like Crohn's disease, including potentially as a neuroprotective agent with regard to brain injury or concussion, for treatment of the multiple symptoms associated with chronic conditions such as fibromyalgia, the treatment of headaches. So really the potential uses of medical cannabis are very, very wide, and there's going to be a catch-up period where we go through the more traditional scientific studies proving efficacy in this wider range of conditions.
Since it seems to be a sort of catch-all, is there any negative to this? And by that I mean, in someone using it, since it seems to be able to do so much, could it attack the body in a way that it wasn't intended for that specific patient?
Well, there are potential harms with any treatment and any medicine. And we do know that medical cannabis has a remarkable safety record. And after thousands of years of human use, we don't yet have any documented fatality by use of either whole plant extracts or specific medical cannabis products. Some of the recreational products that are now being produced that are ultra-concentrated forms of cannabis, we don't yet know whether there are long-term safety implications for some of those products, although it doesn't appear that there are, but to be honest, I don't think we know. But as with any medicine, you always have to weigh the risks and the benefits, and there are some reasons for which patients should not use cannabis products. Now, whether this applies to both recreational and specific medicinal cannabis products, we don't have the evidence. But in general, there are some conditions, such as if you have a family history of certain types of mental illness, it is not recommended that you use cannabis. For a patient who is pregnant or breastfeeding, it's not recommended you use cannabis. And so there are conditions in which we don't recommend it. But in general, there has never been a reported fatality from medical cannabis, which is really remarkable since we have hundreds of deaths attributed to over-the-counter medical products, including, you know, common medicines like acetaminophen and ibuprofen every year. And yet medical cannabis appears to be safer than any of these commonly used over-the-counter medicines that everybody accepts the risks of.
With the legalization last year in Canada of cannabis in general, has that affected, from a medical standpoint, the supply chain that you guys use for medical cannabis?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's been a number of effects due to recreational legalization. You know, for those of us like myself who practice within the medical cannabis industry, we didn't know whether a lot of our patients would leave and just access recreational cannabis. It turns out that that is not the case. In fact, for a lot of older patients, I think I mentioned a lot of seniors are demanding access to medical cannabis products. I think by lifting the stigma off cannabis, by having full legalization, a lot of these more conservative older Canadians are feeling permission to pursue the medical cannabis products, and they are specifically wanting medical cannabis versus recreational products. And yet on the flip side, you asked if the recreational legalization affected product availability. I would say yes overall, just increasing demand overall and not enough production has resulted in some shortages, both of recreational products and medical products. And as the industry matures and sort of adjusts to meet these demands and these supply issues, I think that will be a thing of the past, but currently it's still an issue right now.
And your book, Medical Cannabis in Canada, which is coming out in August, who do you see your prime audience as being for this book?
I would say the prime audience is the general readership who has an interest in understanding medical cannabis in Canada, particularly with regard to the history, with regard to the legislation, with regard to the evidence supporting cannabis medicine, and with regard to advice on how to access and use medical cannabis products for relief of specific symptoms. But because a lot of healthcare providers are not receiving any cannabis-specific education, I do believe there are enough references to peer-reviewed scientific studies that for many healthcare practitioners, it would provide some useful information as well. For somebody who is already, a medical cannabis scientist or someone practicing full-time in this field, I suspect that it will just be reinforcement of information that they're already quite familiar with. But for the general reader, I think there's a lot of new information. And as I mentioned at the beginning of our talk or interview today, this was a compilation of questions that were being asked at almost every talk I went to. So it's an attempt to answer those questions. And those questions were being asked both by a general audience and healthcare provider audience. So hopefully it speaks to both groups.
Mark, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Peter, it's my absolute pleasure. Hope you have a good day.
Dr. Mark Kimmins, author of Medical Cannabis in Canada. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the page for the show, which is show number 0511, and you'll find links to Mark's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, coming to you from Montreal, Canada, where we share the longest unprotected border in the world with the United States. Take that as a sign of extreme friendship or a warning.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to former CIA agent Jason Hansen, author of Agent of Influence. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way, and I've got one more Stuff File news story that I want to share with you here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, a man claimed an argument over $2,000 led his brother to assault him with a guitar, snare drum, and microphone stand inside of a Nashville motel room. Officers responded around 4:45 a.m. to the motel for a report of an assault. According to an arrest affidavit, Benjamin Gregory returned from a bar to the motel room that he shared with his brother, and the siblings argued because the victim's $2,000 was missing. The victim went to shower, and when he walked out of the bathroom, his 26-year-old brother hit him in the head with a wooden guitar.
Holy! Come on!
then struck him multiple times with the guitar, a snare drum, and a microphone stand, causing the victim to lose consciousness.
Holy! Come on!
Benjamin Gregory left the room and drove off, eventually returning to a different motel room to sleep. When officers responded to the motel room where the attack happened, they said they found a broken guitar, microphone stand, and a destroyed snare drum on the floor, along with blood on the floor and on blankets. The suspect was located and was covered in blood stains. Gee, you'd think he'd take those clothes off before he went to bed. Anyway, he was booked into the Metro jail on charges of aggravated assault, property theft, and drug possession. Police said the victim received 8 staples to the back of his head and had multiple abrasions on his arms that were consistent with defensive wounds. He also had minor cuts on both cheeks and other parts of his face. Fighting brothers. How biblical. I guess, like the guitar, the band is broken up. Talk about a one-hit wonder.
Holy! Come on!
Anyway, let's get to our last guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Former CIA officer Jason Hansen, whom we had on the show back in 2015, is back with a new book. Back then, we had him talking about his book, Spy Secrets That Can Save Your Life. His new title is Agent of Influence, How to Use Spy Skills to Persuade Anyone, Sell Anything, and Build a Successful Business. Jason joins us on the line via Skype from Utah. Hi, Jason.
Hey, how you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us once again. Now, when we spoke to you last time, you talked about spy secrets that could save your life. Now, this one, the way I see this book is more like a business book. Aren't you saying that we can use spy tactics, which are kind of covert, in the business world?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things I always say is that spies are the world's best salesmen. That's because you're trying to recruit somebody to obviously spy for your country. And one of my fellow CIA officers, I like how she said it. She said, spies are the world's best salesmen. The only difference is you sell vacuums, I sell treason. So spying can absolutely be applied to the business world.
How so? Give us some examples.
Well, I mean, the spy cycle, it's called the SADR cycle, and it stands for spotting, assessing, developing, and recruiting. And you use that if you're trying to obviously get someone from a foreign government to work with you. But it's the same thing. If you're trying to get a customer, a client, a boss to do what you want to do, you can use that exact same cycle.
What made you write this particular book, Agent of Influence? What was your goal? Who was your target audience?
Well, as you mentioned in the past, most of my books have been about physical danger, meaning how to escape duct tape, how to escape from getting killed, how to use a gun. But the huge part of spying is persuasion. It's, you know, the cliche is basically how to hijack somebody's mind to do what you want them to do. And you can use it in business, you can use it in personal life. So I'm teaching the very important persuasion skills in this book.
Was there an aha moment for you? I mean, you've been trained to be a spy. You were in the CIA. When you got out of that world, was there an aha moment for you when you realized that your skills were indeed transferable?
Yeah, I think there was, because nothing changed. I mean, if I want to target a good customer, I've still got to spot, I've got to assess, I've got to develop, and then I've got to recruit, which is hopefully get them to work with me. So it doesn't change. Obviously, in the spy world, if you screw up, you can get killed, where in the business world, you just lose a deal. So there's obviously a lot less pressure in the business world.
When you talk to people in business, particularly perhaps CEOs and heads of industry, and you expound on this theory, do they drink it in immediately, or are they kind of skeptical in the onset?
No, because the way I explain it, they love it. They realize how easy and efficient and practical it is. So there's as I said, there's a specific formula, a specific cycle, the SADR cycle. And so when I show them how clearly it can be applied, because it is so clear, they love it. It's not a bunch of I can't even say the word. You know what I'm trying to say?
Ambiguous?
It's not ambiguous. Ambiguity. There, I kind of got it.
There you go.
So they love how concrete it is.
When this is applied, and again, it goes back to my first question when I first started talking to you here, shouldn't someone else on the opposite side be concerned that they're, for lack of a better term, being duped or taken?
No, because I always tell people, use this for good and not evil. And, I mean, anybody can do this. It takes deep research. You've got to be willing to put in the work and the effort. And the beauty is, most people are lazy these days. So if you're the one person who actually puts in the effort to do this, you'll likely get the deal and be very successful.
That's an interesting point. You say most people are lazy these days. It sounds like what you're basically espousing are skill sets that perhaps salesmen of two or three generations ago actually had and may have lost over time.
Well, I mean, the beauty of the technological day we live in is you can Google anybody. You can research them by checking their Facebook pages, their, you know, whatever social media they have. And people are even too lazy to do that. I mean, I'll give you an example. I have never sent a text message in my life. So I don't text at all. And I talk about it all the time. I mean, I talk about it in my books. I talk about it in articles. I'm mentioning it here on your show. So every once in a while, I'll get a text message from someone that says, hey, Jason, you know, I got your number from so-and-so. I'd love to work with you. I'd love to do a deal with you. Well, clearly that person did zero work in researching me before pitching me because they sent me a text message and I don't text message.
Which just brings me to another point, and that is how much of what you're espousing is actually, to use a spy term, reconnaissance, doing research before making any kind of contact?
A huge portion. I mean, you have to know how your customer operates, how they tick, what their hot buttons are. So if you don't know your customer better than they know themselves, it's going to be hard to close the deal. And that's why spies are so successful. Before they go pitch somebody, they know everything about them. You know, what kind of scotch they drink, what kind of cigars they smoke, what gym they go to. You know, do they have a mistress? I mean, they know anything and everything. And we can do the same thing because, again, just do Google searches and social media searches.
So in your world, cold calling is never a good idea.
Hopefully not. I mean, if you can avoid it, yes, because you don't have research. You don't have data. I mean, it's like when I get those emails that are clearly blasted emails from another country with broken English of, you know, hi, sir, we are a media company that can make you lots of money. They haven't done any research, which is why those are unsuccessful. So, yeah, I would not recommend cold calling.
We're talking about this in the world of sales, but are there other aspects of business where you're theories based in this book, Agent of Influence, are also as applicable as opposed to just being in sales?
I mean, it can be used to anything you want. I mean, if you're trying to convince your kids to do something, if you're trying to convince your wife, if you have a coworker who you need their support on a new idea you have. So it's psychology at its finest, and we're all human beings. We're all susceptible to psychology, so it can be used anywhere.
And what would happen if I played this answer back for your wife?
She would probably laugh because she has seen me do it and she knows me so well that I'm pretty easy to see through these days.
So an agent of influence does not necessarily work on your wife, at least not from you.
No, because I've kind of trained my enemy. That's the problem. You know, when you train your own spouse in these things, then she becomes good at it.
The book is called Agent of Influence, the subtitle, How to Use Spy Skills to Persuade Anyone, Sell Anything, and Build a Successful Business. Jason, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us once again.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thank you, Peter.
Jason Hansen, author of Agent of Influence, How to Use Spy Skills to Persuade Anyone, Sell Anything, and Build a Successful Business. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the page for this show, which is show number 0511, and you'll find links to Jason's website, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's now time for that moment you've all been waiting for, boys and girls. It's time now for The Idiot
of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A Northern Michigan man is accused of robbing a Walmart store in Alpena three times in one night, stealing $6,000 worth of merchandise. 34-year-old Matthew Brown was charged on May 22nd in an Alpena district court with first-degree retail fraud. Alpena is north of Detroit. If convicted of the charge, a felony, he faces up to 5 years in prison. Police said Brown first entered the Walmart at around 1:30 a.m. on March 22nd and stole some electronic items. He dragged the items to his car, parked in the store's lot, loaded them in, and drove away. But police said that wasn't the end of it. Brown allegedly returned to the store 20 minutes later, took more electronic items, put them in a shopping cart to make things easier, and left without paying. Again, he loaded the items in his car and drove away. And Brown wasn't finished. Said officials in a statement, brazenly, the subject returned to the store a third time and took more merchandise without paying for it. Brown's haul allegedly included 3 50 to 65-inch TVs, a drone, an AT&T cell phone, a computer building kit, a flashlight, a Schwinn bicycle, an HP Pavilion desktop computer, a PS4 racing wheel, and a Western Digital 6-terabyte hard drive. After reviewing security footage and interviewing witnesses, police visited Brown at his home and found much of the stolen property. They also found items from the store in Brown's car. Now, why? Oh, why? Would you think that you could manage to rob the same Walmart store, not once, not twice, but three times in the same night and get away with it? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0511. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0511. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Well, you weren't literally with him. Well, maybe you were, but I don't see how. I mean, he does record these in advance, you know. Okay, maybe you did listen with him. Who am I to call you a liar? And personally, I've never met the guy, and I'm not in a hurry to either.